Try 4 weeks of The Spectator absolutely free. And, for this month only, you'll receive a Spectator wireless phone charger. Go to www.spectator.co.uk/charger.
Hello and welcome to Coffeehouse Shots, The Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Katie Balls and I'm joined by Fraser Nelson and James Forsyth. Is Boris Johnson about to become a proponent of the nanny state? That's the suggestion in the papers today, with James's column in The Times pointing to the fact that the Prime Minister is changing his views on obesity and how best to tackle it. James, what's going on?
So one of the constants of Boris Johnson's journalistic and political career has been his kind of opposition to nanny state interventions in people's lives. In 2006, he overshadowed David Cameron's first conference as Tory leader by backing mothers who were kind of pushing pies through railings in opposition to the imposition of a new kind of Jamie Oliver inspired healthy school dinners menu. As recently as the Tory leadership contest last year, he was attacking the sugar tax, saying that it was regressive and that it didn't work. But I think his own personal experiences with COVID-19 have kind of changed his mind on this stuff. He is convinced that the reason he ended up in ICU was because of his weight. He was 17 and a half stone when he was admitted to hospital. And that as the government kind of tries to work out why the UK has been hit so hard by this virus, it is coming to the conclusion that obesity is one of the major factors. You know, more than one in four Brits are obese. And the medical research shows that after age, obesity is the second biggest risk factor with coronavirus. And so government policy at the moment is based on the assumption that there's no guarantee that there'll be a vaccine anytime soon, and so it's trying to work out how this country can live with the virus, how it can adjust to this new reality. And obviously, if you're going to lessen the toll taken by this virus, one of the things you need to do is to take action on obesity now, to start reducing the levels of obesity in the population. And if you can do that, you'll begin to make the population less vulnerable to being hospitalised or dying from coronavirus.
Fraser, we have some new terms now in government for those who potentially at risk of coronavirus due to their weight and those who aren't, with the Prime Minister saying it's all right for the thinnies of Downing Street. Do you think this is the type of lingo we're going to hear more of in the months to come?
Yes, I certainly do. I mean, to be honest, this has been going on for years now. I remember when Simon Stevens became chief exec of the NHS years ago, he was struck by how in the American model, he'd come from the States, that a lot more was done to stop your clients, if you're a healthcare company, from getting sick in the first place. So they would incentivize going to the gym, keeping a healthy lifestyle, because it's amazing how many expensive health problems stem from basically being out of shape. High blood pressure, diabetes, cancer, all these things are linked to whether you're in shape or not. Now, in theory, the NHS ought to be very good at doing this because it's one big system, we're in touch with our GP. In practice, they struggle to get that message across. So now and again, we see government toying with a sugar tax or other things, which obviously hit the poorest hardest. So then you end up basically back where you started, knowing that the country should be slimmer, but not quite knowing what to do about it. But now the coronavirus places all this in a very different context, because you're far more likely to be ending up in serious problems in hospital for this if you're overweight than if you're not. Now, having reached that conclusion, what isn't clear to me is what Boris Johnson's going to do about it. It's all very well to talk about thinnies as if they're kind of genetically privileged. It's not entirely clear what he's going to do to make us lose weight, because this lockdown, I have to say, is not the best way of losing weight. So I wonder, even if he does have a new focus on this, will he be able to come up with a new policy to get us to cut down on the pork? I somewhat doubt it.
James, how do you think he is going to do this? Because one thing is clearly cycling. We know the Prime Minister is a big supporter and advocate of cycling, even though he can't currently do it due to security reasons. The government have announced £2 billion already to try and improve cycling lanes, get more people on their bike. But are we also looking at potential future taxes? We had sin taxes during Boris's leadership campaign as something he was against, but could we actually start to see more sugar taxes and things similar in the future?
Katie, I think as you said, getting people to take more exercise, you know, more cycle hire schemes, more bike racks, you know, that's the politically easy bit. No one is going to object to that. The more difficult thing is, you know, how do you deter people from eating the kinds of food and drinking the kinds of drinks that make them fat in the first place? Now, I don't think any decision on this has been reached, but I am struck by how many senior ministers are now in favour of extending the sugar tax, and some surprising people in Downing Street too. And ringing round Tory MPs in the last few days, I've been struck by how opinion on the backbenches is changing too. There are still some diehard opponents of the tax and who would object to it being extended. But there were also people who, during the last time round, were very much against the sugar tax, who have now come round to it. But because, as you said, because of coronavirus, as Fraser said, you know, it has put all of these debates in a different context. I also think there's a fascinating thing. The Prime Minister's special advisor on health matters is someone called William Waugh, and he did postdoctoral research at Oxford showing that one of the most effective interventions is a doctor telling someone to their face that they need to lose weight. It's very hard for people to ignore that. But despite that, more than half of all obese patients had no memory of their doctor urging them to lose weight. There is a view among doctors that it's either not their job to do this or that doing so would harm their relationship with the patient. So I think one of the challenges for government is to come up with a way to incentivize doctors to tell people to lose weight. Because if we could become a thinner country, it wouldn't just help in this fight against coronavirus. It would also protect the NHS in a whole host of other ways. For example, the cost of treating type 2 diabetes, which is linked to obesity, is about £5 billion a year.
Now, Fraser, when it comes to Boris Johnson's desire to get the nation fit, this is part of a broader effort to work out how to live with coronavirus. But there's new information, new data, suggesting that how we live with coronavirus could need to be different depending on where exactly we live in the United Kingdom. In your Telegraph column today, you write about how the R number is so drastically different in various parts of the UK that there could actually be a strong argument for easing the lockdown significantly in some places, but not others.
That's right. In his cover story this week, Fredrik Eriksson looks across Europe and America at how this is being handled. And what he points out is in almost every single country, there is a regional aspect to this. Now, we're used to these league tables showing Italy doing badly, Germany doing well, etc. But those are very misleading because inside these countries, you've Lombardy, for example, in the north of Italy, very badly hit. The south of Italy, not at all. In Sweden, you've got Stockholm, very badly hit. Malmö in the south, but not at all. I think Stockholm's five times worse than Malmö. And in Britain, you've got London, which is very badly hit, and then the southwest, not at all. Now, it's not entirely clear why COVID behaves this way. It doesn't spread evenly throughout the population as influenza tends to do. But nonetheless, this is what it is. And every country in Europe is taking a regional approach out of lockdown. So in Spain, for example, Madrid is staying in a harsher lockdown than the rest of the country. In Germany, you're getting the various Länder are behaving differently. In America, you're getting South Dakota way more liberal than, say, Chicago. And in Britain, it stands to reason that Scotland ought to be a bit more cautious than England if Scotland is struggling to control the virus in the same way as parts of England. And of course, the word England here is very misleading because you've got the east of England where there are still, I think, something like 3,000 or 4,000 new cases diagnosed every day. And then London, where the number of cases diagnosed a day is more like 20. Now, that is such an incredible figure that when I was researching my column yesterday, I didn't think it could be true. I thought, this is surely one of these modelling glitches. How can there be 11,000 infections in all of England, but only 20 in London? So I then looked up the actual testing data, because we're doing lots of tests now, and you can split that up if you plug the computer hard enough. And if you pull out the London figure, then yes, it corresponds. The London figure, the number of people who test positive for COVID in London can be measured in the dozens. So it is the case that this city that we're talking in now, the city of 9 million souls, will every day get a couple of dozen new COVID cases. That's something like a 99% reduction on the number of cases at the peak. So London itself is almost free of the virus. The models say so, the tests say so, and this has got implications, I think, for what you do in lockdown. Can we really justify keeping kids out of the classroom, denying them their education, if the virus risk in this city is now negligible? Some very serious questions here, and I would like the Prime Minister to turn his attention to them, because he was right in saying, as he did a couple of weeks ago, you can't let the northeast of England be held back if there's an outbreak in Cornwall. The same logic applies to London. If we've made progress here in hitting a level of immunity that might make the virus less likely to proceed, that does raise very interesting questions about whether we can start to reopen society.
Now, James, the government has spoken previously about how they wanted the whole of the United Kingdom to go out of lockdown or ease lockdown together. But if there were flare-ups in the future, they would be happy and prepared to reapply restrictions to specific areas, very targeted. Ultimately, this week we've seen the devolved administration taking a slightly different path. But do you think we can now have a situation where the government would choose to ease lockdown in different parts of the UK?
So when Fraser told me these numbers yesterday, I mean, it was a kind of proper marmalade dropper moment. You know, the idea that there are this few new infections in London is really quite striking. I think that, as you said, Katie, the government's view was we're going to kind of all come out of lockdown at the same time, but then you might clamp down on a new hotspot that emerged. If you've got a cluster of cases in, say, Bristol, Bristol schools might shut, Bristol retail might shut, and you'd attempt to control the virus there. But I think there is a question here. Now, Fraser was having a debate on the Jeremy Vine show earlier today with Steve Brine, the public health minister under Theresa May. And he was saying, well, you know, you can't do this because what would happen is my constituents in Winchester would become pub tourists going to London to drink and then coming back. You know, I know that the regional mayors have conveyed a very similar message to Downing Street, which is, you know, if you end up easing the lockdown in London first, you know, it'll become impossible to police it here. But I wonder whether that is right, because the evidence seems to suggest that the public are very wary about going out even once lockdown is lifted. And so if you had an easing of restrictions in London, I doubt you would have people flooding into the capital from the rest of the country to take advantage of them. Now, I think the other big question is, how does public transport in London do? Because this is the big kind of question, which is, if any significant number of people go back to work in London, it will become impossible to socially distance on the tube. I've only been into the Spectator office once since lockdown was introduced. It was sort of something that technically couldn't be done if you weren't in the office. And I was surprised at how empty the tube is. But then, talking to someone who was on the tube this morning, they were saying, you know, look, now it is now sufficiently full at rush hour that you are inevitably closer to people than 2 metres apart. You know, there are people sitting pretty much in every seat and some people standing. And so that is obviously the question, which is, how much does London is so dependent on its public transport system, whether it be tubes or buses. And if the city goes back to work, it is going to be impossible to maintain social distancing on those services. Even if you've got a kind of massive uptick in cycling, as Boris Johnson wants, you wouldn't be able to do that. So I think the question becomes, you know, how much do you think that sitting next to someone on a tube journey, you know, how much is that going to use the parlance? How much is that going to take up of your R budget?
Now, the other news we've had today relates to Brexit. The Brexit negotiations are not going at the pace the UK government would like, and we seem to be getting to that point, Fraser, where it's hard to see right now how both sides are going to be able to come to an agreement on time in terms of an FTA. What do you think's coming down the track?
Yeah, we've had a pretty striking statement from David Frost, the Brexit negotiator. He basically said, as Michel Barnier says, we're not making much progress. But he was saying this is because of the EU's ideological approach to this. The EU, as he says, his exact words, the major obstacle is the EU's insistence on including a set of novel and unbalanced proposals on the level playing field that would bind this country to EU law or standards in a way that's unprecedented. Now, he basically is saying that we're not talking about details here. We're talking about fundamentals. Should Britain have to agree on giving anything away in the fishery? They're not even entering a discussion. The UK side is saying, no, sorry, this is off the table. And the EU side is saying, well, sorry, we can't talk to you then because your minimal offering is greater than our minimal requirement. So we're seeing a situation now where there might be a blow-up in Brexit talks sooner rather than later. Now, This raises quite an interesting prospect of a June blow-up. We were told that in June, that was when the rough Brexit deal was supposed to have been agreed. Now, if there's nothing even close to a Brexit deal by June, then the alternative is to go for a WTO. As Wolfgang Munchau wrote in The Spectator a couple of weeks ago, there is now a lot less to fear from a world trade Brexit deal than there was before because of a disruption of the COVID crisis, because global supply chains have been so broken. Then the gulf between what is happening, the situation now, versus a hard Brexit is a far smaller gap than would have been the case before COVID. So we can see now the government adopting a far more bullish verbal stance to this, almost as if verbally they're preparing for a Brexit blow-up, and they're preparing for that in a matter of weeks.
James, do you think we're heading to a no-deal Brexit, or perhaps I should rephrase, an Australia-style arrangement?
So I think the differences between the UK and the EU, often in trade talks, the differences are quite technical. You know, how do you define what a widget is, for example? But the differences between the UK and the EU are much more high-level than that. They're almost philosophical details. The UK view is, we just want, just in inverted commas, want a free trade deal, so why won't you give us a deal like you've given Canada, South Korea, Japan? The EU point is, the UK is too big, too intertwined with the EU economy for that to happen, so the UK has to have far more obligations placed on it to ensure a level playing field. Now, I mean, the size of these differences are why Downing Street is so uninterested in extension. Their view is more time spent sitting around talking or even Zooming isn't going to solve these differences. They think actually that what might force an agreement is actually the pressure of a deadline. Because as Fred said, in June, the UK and the EU need to decide whether they are going to proceed with the negotiations or whether they're just going to accept that they can't do a deal and so they will be trading on WTO terms at the end of all this. And I think the Downing Street view is, you know, look, only if you're actually forced to confront that choice can you get a deal. Now, I think one of the things that is difficult is that last time round, everything looked very grim, like there was not going to be a deal. And then Boris Johnson and Leo Varadkar, the Irish Taoiseach, met at Thornton Manor, this wedding venue in Cheshire. They went for a walk around the grounds on their own, just the two of them, and they basically sketched out a deal that could be done between the two sides. The problem is that this time round, there are 28 countries with interests at stake in this negotiation. And so that kind of one-on-one diplomacy to come up with a deal is much more difficult.
Thank you, James. Thank you, Fraser. And thank you for listening.
Try 4 weeks of The Spectator absolutely free. And for this month only, you'll receive a Spectator wireless phone charger. Go to www.spectator.co.uk/charger.